Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for making the effort to find your way here on this dark, almost winter morning. You'll be aware of the topic for today's seminar. There is a preliminary issue which turns on the pronunciation of the title to the Act. I think it reminds one of the refrain of the old song. I think it went something like, "You say tomato, I say tomato." And Daniel Jones, who's still, I think, regarded as the authority on pronunciation, says that he prefers privacy, but says that privacy is acceptable among the people whom he regards as determinative of that issue. So nobody will be expelled if he or she says privacy in the course of this morning. but on a more serious note, the Privacy Act took effect, as amended, took effect on the 12th of March this year, and the amendments to it have been substantial. The main effect of the amendment has been to replace the national privacy principles and information privacy principles with what are called Australian privacy principles, or APPs, which are set out in Schedule 1 of the Consolidated Act. Those principles are binding on what are called APP entities, and that refers to agencies and organisations. Agency, in turn, means, in effect, any Commonwealth agency, such as a government department, a minister, any Commonwealth court or tribunal. And organisation is defined in section, pardon me, section 6, capital C of the Act, to mean an individual, a body corporate, a partnership, any other unincorporated association or a trust that is not a small business operator, a registered political party, an agency, or state, territory, authority, or a prescribed instrumentality of a state or territory. And then, just to further complicate the matter, subsection 2 says a legal person can have a number of different capacities in which the person does things. In each of those capacities, the person is taken to be a different organisation. Now, on at first glance, one might have thought that that makes it easy for small business operators, but I won't trespass any more on the time of our speakers, other than to observe that there are exceptions to the apparent exception for small business operators, and they are extremely complicated. But this morning, our speakers are going to deal first with questions of enforcement, and then the second presenter, will David Sanders, will deal with the question of compliance. first presenter, Simon Miner. The order's been slightly reversed. David will deal with the question of compliance first. The format of this morning is that each presenter will speak to his paper. The papers won't be read, they'll be available for distribution if you haven't already got one. Each speaker will take about 15 minutes. We'll then break for coffee and have a question and answer session after that. So I'll simply hand over to David, who we're fortunate to learn has an extensive background in information technology. He has degrees in both computer science and law from Monash University. He has been the managing director of a major IT consulting business, and before coming to the bar, he served for a time as a judge's associate. He's able to draw on hands-on experience. He has a deep understanding of commercial and technical and practical circumstances of his clients, as well as his special interest in the subject of this morning's seminar, he deals in his practice with wills and estates, employment and intellectual property law, and is a consultant on matters relating to cyber crime. he's also actively involved in not-for-profit and charitable activities, and is an occasional speaker at the Monash University postgraduate law program. He's a member of a number of professional bodies focused on his legal areas of interest and on alternative dispute resolution as a member of the Chartered Institute of Arbitrators. So I'd ask you to welcome David and to listen attentively to his presentation.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming in so early. I know there's at least some of you that's a very special effort, which I appreciate. Firstly, let me tell you... Is that better? Let me tell you what this is not. This is not an in-depth discussion of anything that you're going to hear. The Privacy Act on its own is so obtuse and complex that no one, I think, can do even a small part of it justice in the time we have this morning. So what I hope to do for you is leave you with a bit of background material, most of which I will not touch on at all this morning, and just give you a whistle-stop tour of a few of the changes that have recently come into place. The paper that you have, though, does go into a little bit more of background material and some more detail of what we'll touch on. Don has already mentioned there were extensive changes to the Act earlier this year that came into effect in mid-March. We had plenty of warning, but still most people from all of the affected professions, other than the top end of town, really did very little. The amending changes to the Privacy Act were broad in scope, and they implemented 161 of 259 recommendations from a recent, well, recent being 2008, ALRC report into changes. We are ignoring almost all of those changes this morning, other than Simon will be talking about the new enforcement regime, and I'll be touching on the changes to some of the principles that sit behind it. But it's worth knowing that credit reporting has changed. There are now recognition of external dispute resolution mechanisms and new powers in the Information Commission. Of the 259 recommendations, 98 are still to come. So this is an area that is changing. I'll briefly touch on that. I thought it was worthwhile raising, you'll find a number of quotes, some amusing, some not, in the paper that I've left, but this is some academic comment that sets out in one paragraph the history of the Act. And it says that the Act came in 1988, Commonwealth Public Sector 1990, applied to credit reporting, then got amended in 2000, the same year as Y2K, and the GST, for those of you with business interests, to apply to the private sector. That was largely what we've come to accept and work with. But this is academic comment. Then the 2012 amendments were passed, which make the Privacy Act Commonwealth unequivocally the most privacy-hostile data protection law in the world. And that's ours. That's the one that we have. It then goes on to talk about exceptions, exemptions, authorisations designed in loopholes scattered throughout it. The complexities are such that there are many unintended loopholes, ambiguities and uncertainties. Corporations, expensive lawyers, consultants spend a lot of time finding multiple ways in which organisations can breach data privacy but not data privacy law. Now that might be a slightly cynical view from one side of the fence. From there, from the other side of the fence, it's better than nothing. And from another side of that same fence, it's a lot of regulatory burden upon businesses. I'll just briefly skim over this. What is protected under the Act? Interferences with privacy of an individual. So the first thing to note is it's only individual privacy that matters. And privacy for purposes of the Act is not privacy in the common sense of the word. It in no way affects the peeping Tom looking through the window. It is really only concerned about information privacy or information management. It protects the handling of personal information. Now this is a new definition, so this is one of the things that have changed. The underlined sections in these slides are the significantly new material. There is now the concept of it's not just enough to have information that identifies a person, but it could also be indirect identification of someone who is reasonably identifiable. So for instance, the big guy with glasses and a beard who presented at the Greens breakfast on this date is actually now personal information, because that is now sufficient to identify me. It's not just name, it's not just usernames. So descriptive components can be included. Skype handles, email addresses, all sorts of things fall into that category. And as a really rough rule, if you can put it into Google and get something out, or if you can put it into another database in a related entity or industry component, then it's protected. Sensitive information is special casing of the private information, personal information. Sensitive information attracts higher obligations to look after. And most of it you'll recognise as material that discrimination is founded upon, but it adds and includes health information, genetic information, biometric IDs. So for those of you that have clients or work in an organisation where a fingerprint scan is used as part of authentication, then the data associated with that fingerprint scan is now potentially covered under the Privacy Act. Employee records are not protected. This has always been a controversial effort. I just note in passing that employee records, which cover all sorts of things, including disciplinary processes, are excluded from the Act, but only so far as the employer is concerned. So subcontractors are not covered, records related to subcontractors, and third parties to the relationship cannot rely on this exemption. So what is an employee record to me might be personal information to you. Don's mentioned the exceptions that apply to who it covers. I'm ignoring Commonwealth agencies and so on this morning and just considering the business component. Any business with an annual turnover of more than $3 million, this Act applies to. Anyone that opts in, it applies to. Any business that provides a health service, which has a very broad definition, which includes assessing and recording, maintaining and improving health or diagnosis. So that would include the sole proprietor personal fitness trainer. That would include the Chinese masseuse at the local shopping centre. That would include some community groups that have a focus on a particular disability or a particular area of health. Any business that shares or unsells customer contact information, again, no matter how big or small, is within the scheme of this Act. And there are exemptions to the exemptions to the exemption in this Act. This is a confusing area. breaches are classed in context of a failing to comply or acting in a way or a practice that is contrary or inconsistent with the APPs, which Don has mentioned, and you must not do that. That, in not many minutes, is the backwork to who the background to who gets covered under this Act. So the rough rule is more businesses than you think are probably covered under the Act because of the exemptions, but any business that has a turnover of $3 million or more is definitely covered under this Act. So any of you that work for an entity that has that turnover or more, or any of you that have clients with that turnover or more, this is relevant. As an idea of the complexity of the APPs, these are the set of unifying principles that weigh in at about 5,000 words that replace the earlier principles from the earlier versions of the Act that weighed in two separate cases, one for private and one for public sector, at something less than that, at 4,800. So we've unified everything and made it bigger, and it's in no way more streamlined than what was there before. The guideline document that the Office of the Australian Information Commissioner publishes, the guidelines, which does not include a copy of the APPs, is 211 pages long. So have a think about that when you're thinking about your small business or medium enterprise clients and what prospects they have of wading through that on their own without assistance and complying. One of the good things about it is it's technology neutral. So at no point does it refer to a particular technology. It doesn't distinguish between emails or texts or a piece of paper stapled to a wall. All of those things fall within the scheme of the Act. I'm just going to briefly flick through the APPs that are here and pull out a few of the changes. The broad concepts are actually similar to what's previously been the place. So if you've got identifying information and you have consent to its use, then you're most of the way there under the scheme of the Act. APP 1 is all about transparent management of personal information, and it introduces the change that it is no longer enough to have a privacy policy in an organisation. You actually have to implement it. A rather important change. It's no longer enough to have a privacy statement on a website. You actually have to be able to demonstrate that you have steps and processes and systems behind the scenes that will give effect to that policy. So you've got to actually do, not just say you will do. There is now guidance on what a policy must contain, and 90-something percent or more of the existing website privacy policies will be in breach of this already if they have not been recently amended because of the likely to disclose personal information to overseas recipients. This is one of the new additions to the APPs. It's an underlying thread that wherever information is shared with another party in another country, there's now an obligation to disclose that. That's there. So your privacy policies, even very good privacy policies from the past, would be unlikely to have said, by the way, our servers are located in Poland and our back office accounting is in China. And now there's an obligation to disclose those countries. Coles.com.au have identified the 23 countries that your information when you interact with that website might go to. Small enterprises typically don't know where their websites have been hosted or who is looking after the database. That is now an important thing. I'll touch on disclose That's an important word to mark. There is now an obligation that where practicable, you must be able to interact with a client using pseudonyms. So they need to have the ability where it's practicable to be anonymous or have pseudonyms. So websites that have things like proceed as guest comply with that. If I don't have to identify myself to give effect to the transaction, then I don't have to. The scheme of collecting solicited personal information when I ask for it. One of the changes here, you must have a need. You have to be able to identify to the Privacy Commissioner what the actual present need is for that information. Gone are the days where you can just collect information in the possibility it might be relevant to the future business from there. So some businesses will probably end up changing their defined business processes and models to more expressly include that component of, and I gather information in the hope of furthering my relationship with clients in the future as I learn more or I can do more. Consent is crucial. It is a complex area in its own right. Consent can be express, I click the button, or it can be inferred on the basis of it's reasonably foreseeable that to provide the service that I'm offering, I need to use this thing in this way. So inferred consent is available for, say, my overseas back office accounts functions. There is a new requirement of lawful and fair. Unsolicited information, this is a whole new regime, and it introduces extra tests, and you now have an obligation to actually place a determination, actually make a decision on the basis of information that you have not expressly requested. Think about the issues of the unsolicited resume, the website inquiry that occur. Notifications, nothing new there. Use or disclosure, it is all about consent. Direct marketing starts off with must not use or disclose personal information, but there are so many exceptions that any company that follows the right formula will be able to do it. There won't be an issue, you've just got to follow the process. APP 8 is the controversial one. It's totally new. Before you disclose, you must take reasonable steps to ensure that your third party is bound by similar principles to what the APPs are here, whether that's because they're in a jurisdiction where there's statutory requirements or whether there is an enforceable contract, doesn't matter, but you need to be able to identify it and you need to get the appropriate consents or disclosures. Can't use government identifiers. There's provisions relating to the quality of personal information. Again, nothing controversial about this. If I have someone else's information, it must be of a reasonable quality, though there is now the concept of it has to be up to date, whatever that means. So that's an additional one. Security, this is a hot topic from the past Act that carries through at the question of what are reasonable steps to protect personal information. I think this is one of the most challenging areas for any enterprise that is brought into the scheme not having realised that they are previously covered or now having to deal with it, particularly is an issue in the IT space. There is a complete guide to what reasonable steps are, most of which I suggest are unrealistic for many small businesses, but nonetheless must be considered. There are two APPs that relate to access to personal information. I have the right to find out what you know about me, and I have the right to have it corrected. Again, nothing controversial there, other than if the entity refuses to correct, they must be able to record a statement of the fact that I have said this is wrong and what I have said. There are a number of live issues. My time for this part is up, but I'll just leave you with, and the paper raises some of these as well. Reasonable steps, what they are, particularly for small, medium-sized enterprises, for protection of data is a serious issue. Cloud computing, which everyone is using even if they don't realise it, If you don't think that's the case, think of whether you've got a Gmail account, a Dropbox account, whether you use Microsoft Live, OneDrive, any of these things. Almost all of you will be using cloud computing from here, and medium-sized enterprises in particular with back-office functions. There are other things that are covered in the paper. That's my time for now.
Yes, well, thank you, David. As I've indicated, the time for questions will be at the end of the presentation by each speaker. So I'll call on Simon Minahan to give his presentation now. Simon was admitted to practice in 1991 and came to the bar in 1992. He has a wide-ranging commercial law practice with a particular emphasis on intellectual property and insolvency. He holds a degree of Master of Laws in Intellectual Property and Information Technology Law, and he's advised and appeared in all jurisdictions in cases within his area of specialty. And he's also had extensive experience in both litigation and alternative dispute resolution, particularly in commercial and trade practices disputes. he has a special niche in mediation and arbitration of domain name disputes. So Simon, like David, is especially well qualified to address this highly complex and newly reformulated area, which has such wide-ranging implications for our commercial community and for individuals, as David has pointed out. So I'll ask Simon now to make his presentation.
Thanks, Don. I don't have slides because I find invariably they're more interesting than I am. So I'm just going to have to pin your ears back. I'm focusing on enforcement, and as David indicated, the new Act introduces a couple of additional regimes relating to credit reporting in particular, quite an extensive regime. Which we're simply not going to address this morning. We're really looking at private enterprises and the way the new Act affects them. And one of the key aspects of the new Act is that it has given the Office of the Australian Information Commissioner, you may know him as the Privacy Commissioner, teeth that they didn't used to have. David's already canvassed broadly the APPs, the new set of principles, and what the Privacy Commissioner or the Commissioner now has is a raft of remedies, regulatory powers to monitor the way those principles are being upheld, to require either government agencies or private organisations to modify their behaviour or cease and desist in behaviour, to extend that to declarations of right for individuals and order compensation, including, if need be, aggravated damages, and can do that on its own motion or on a complaint, and can do it with or without having a hearing if it so desires. There is no upper limit to how much compensation can be ordered, although to date it's been modest, generally speaking, but there's no reason why it needs to stay that way. In addition, there are civil penalty provisions so that if the Commission desires, it can effectively prosecute for a civil penalty, and it can take and enforce undertakings from parties. So there's a raft of new regulatory powers, which are supported by investigative powers that include some compulsion items. So what I thought I'd do is a general survey. There's a paper that discusses broadly, and let me say the Act is, I think they handed it over to an insurance company to redraft, because it's done by that terrible process, which I think is logical and satisfies drafters, but it becomes a nightmare to understand. There's a blanket statement, then there is a blanket carve out, and then there's an add back in, and then, oh, we thought of something more, we'll carve back out. So you end up with a body of principle that's got major holes in it, like cysts all the way through it, that then get filled back up. And so it's it's full of uncertainty. There's not a lot of case law, obviously enough. So there's a fair bit of first principle deduction required. And there's a fair bit there that isn't particularly well defined. For instance, consent is not in fact defined in the Act. Now, that's probably not uncommon to a lot of legislation, but it leaves us as advisors with some trepidation, because we've got to fill in those blanks for clients until they are filled in by either authority or legislation. So, as Don said at the outset, the Act applies to entities, and entities are essentially divided into government agencies, which are called agencies, or private businesses. Although be aware that contractors acting for government agencies will fall within the wider and stricter rules that affect the Commonwealth, so that it can be that private enterprises get dragged up into the agency propositions. So the regulatory powers available, I'll mention some that affect agencies only, but essentially I'm concentrating on what would affect your likely clients, or most clients will be private individuals. So the first thing to note is that there is still essentially a broad educative and monitoring role for the office and for the commissioner. And in that capacity, they can offer or undertake what's called a privacy assessment under Section 33C of the Act. And that is essentially an audit to see if you are, or your organisation is, complying with the APPs and has the right structures and the like in place. And you can in fact invite them along to do that, although I'm not sure how many people would. But so they have the ability to go into an organisation and say, all right, show us your processes, open them up, we want to see, we want to know if you've got complying systems and whether your general principles. So privacy assessments are one tool. They then can also direct an agency, this doesn't apply to individuals, to give them a privacy impact assessment, so to do a study internally of what they are doing and the way it impacts on privacy. They can, the commissioner can register a code of conduct. At the moment, only one of any significance has been registered. I think there were two before the changes, and there's a credit reporting one that's been registered since. It's almost, I can't really comprehend why they've done it. It doesn't do anything much, but it sits together with another tool that's available to the commission, which is that they can make binding or advisory guidelines. The commission, now, binding guidelines are, again, rare. They're essentially a legislative instrument. So that once declared, they become a code which any party covered by them has to comply with. And again, credit reporting agencies are subject at the moment to a binding guideline, which is to be read in conjunction with the enforceable code. It's meant to add some more substance to the general run of lengthy and specific provisions in the Act affecting credit reporting. Other than that, at the moment, there are no enforceable codes or binding guidelines. Advisory guidelines I guess, are not dissimilar to some of the tax commissioner's powers. The commission can give, and on their website have published dozens of guidelines relating to the various principles and different aspects of their operation and how the commission will approach the assessment of compliance and how best to design, etc. They obviously don't have legislative force, and this is part of the educational aspect. So that's a sort of the general powers. We get to the point here and when we come to consider their investigative power, which is section 40 and thereafter. They've got much wider power to investigate than they previously enjoyed. So they can investigate on I'll go back one step. There are two aspects for enforcement. Under 6B, there are breaches, or 6A and 6B, there are breaches of the APPs, of the Australian Privacy Principles. So if the Commissioner thinks there is a breach, that can trigger an investigation by them and a whole range of enforcement propositions. The other concept is an interference with privacy, which seems essentially to be directed to individual rights. And so the Commissioner can investigate an interference of privacy on the complaint of any subject. They have to make an initial assessment of whether in fact the complaint's justified, and the process contemplated is that the complainant should first go to the organisation concerned and make the complaint with them and go through an internal process. And it's a ground for the Commissioner, who has the right to refuse to investigate or to cease an investigation, if that hasn't happened. And the process is clearly contemplated that you start with your provider, you start with the information holder. They should conciliate if possible. If they can't, then the Commissioner can investigate. Part B is that the Commissioner can commence an investigation of their own motion, wherever he or she thinks he at the moment there is an interference with privacy or a breach of the Act. Now, breach is just, are your practices complying with the APPs? That's the question for a breach. And that is also the one area of exception where an individual complaint need not have gone to the party complained about, the offending party, if I'm calling that. You don't have to take it there if it's actually just a flat-out breach, or if the Commissioner feels that it would be unreasonable to expect the complainant to have gone to the source in the first place. So there's a classic example. You've got a power to investigate, but you won't investigate unless there's already been a complaint internally, but there doesn't have to be a complaint internally if you don't think that's reasonable or it's a breach. And that's before you even bounce the ball. So the investigations can take any form the Commissioner likes, but he has to consider whether or not to investigate at all under Section 41 that's set out. Then if he decides to investigate, there's a range of powers available. He can conduct preliminary inquiries, which you would expect. He can decide not to move forward. He can require information or documents to be produced, effectively on a summons, or more like a subpoena, I suppose. He can require people to attend to answer questions. He can require them to take the oath, and he can administer the oath. So that there's a full range of compulsion powers for investigation. And failure to comply with any of those directions from the Commissioner is an offence and can be prosecuted in the Federal Court or the Federal Circuit Court. He can refer complaints to the DPP or any other body that would have oversight and the power to prosecute. But once referred, he's got to desist in his investigations. So that's a pretty broad range and classically strong investigative power. That process then ends up in what's called a determination, which is governed by Section 52. A determination can be made without a hearing, or the Commissioner can elect to have a hearing, or a party who's being investigated or about whom an investigation is proceeding can request a hearing. There's no particular procedural guideline for how that hearing will be conducted. So there are then a range of options open to a commissioner in making a determination, which obviously range from dismissing a complaint through to taking an enforceable undertaking from an organisation, or then making declarations that a principle or has been breached or there has been interference with privacy. You can declare or direct that any reasonable act to correct the process can be undertaken, or that someone should desist from an act. Again, as I said earlier, order compensation to be paid to the complainant, and that seems includes aggravated damages if they think it's appropriate, or a very broad range of determinations available. Those determinations are enforceable in the Federal Court or the Federal Circuit Court, and in cases of breach there are also powers available to get civil penalty provisions, obviously. Quasi-criminal sanctions and fines. So they can seek an injunction if need be, and in obtaining interlocutory injunctions, they're not required to give an undertaking as to damages. So those determinations are essentially a delegated combination of investigation and prosecution power, with the determination also lying in the hands of the Commission. Now, all those decisions can be reviewed under the ADJR as a hearing de novo in the Federal Court or the Federal Circuit Court, in which process the Commissioner can give a certificate of evidence, which stands as prima facie evidence of anything that was decided, and his reasons go up, although they're not binding, because it's a hearing de novo. So organisations have to be aware now that although the emphasis is still on conciliation first and enforcement second, there are much broader powers and much more effective powers of investigation and enforcement. You'll find at the back, I'm just about to wrap up, although I think the formatting dropped out a little, I've taken an extract out of the one decision that's been published on the Office's website dealing with the new Act, although it's dealing with some conduct that occurred before the Act, which I'll just trespass into our coffee time in a minute, involved a blind fellow who'd been to, I think, Queensland for a procedure, was returning and at the airport was with a companion who was assisting them, essentially, and was approached by the airline staff and asked whether he needed certain things because of his condition. And he had, in addition to his sight issues, he had other medical issues which were not apparent and which were discussed in the lobby of an airport by the airline staff saying, well, do you need assistance, I gather? And he took exception and complained that this was a breach of his privacy. It was an unreasonable way to approach him, an unreasonable way to disclose or obtain information in a public spot, and that he was offended by it. The airline resisted. They went through a conciliation process. It didn't work. So the Commissioner got involved and the Commissioner made a determination in which he awarded damages. So it's an interesting decision because what it does is reiterate some of the principles that the Commission will apply with reference to a case called Rummery, which is all the Office of the Information Commission reports are on Ostley, you can find them. And it's at the back of the paper. I won't go into it, but I just suggest you have a look at it. And it has a discussion of how compensation will be considered and awarded, including the possibility of aggravated damages. Time being against us, I'll leave there and perhaps have a coffee and come back and do some Q&A.